I'm Mark Steiner, and you know who that is. The wonderful Bob Marley. Redemption song, Bob Marley and the Wailers. On this day in 1984, the posthumous Bob Marley compilation, Legend, began a 12-week run at number one on the charts, one of the great albums of all time. And we're about to have a conversation we have been looking forward to for some time. As I told you last week, Betty Metzger was speaking at the Enoch Pratt Library, and she's here with us to have a conversation on the day she's been visiting Baltimore. She wrote the book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. She's from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where she was born, I mean to say. And she's former chair of the Department of Journalism at San Francisco State University, founder of the Center for Integration and Improvement of Journalism, author of many books, including Winds of Change and Women at Work. What she did was break a story back in 1970 about the theft of FBI files and put them in the Washington Post, where she was then a reporter. And has now gone back to look at this history, found the people who actually did the break-in, and told this amazing story, and joins us here in our studios. And Betty Metzger, welcome. Good to have you here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this period of time, I think this is an amazing story, because those who know history know about Watergate, and those who know history, we've talked in this show about the Church Commission that kind of unraveled some of the intenseness and underhanded things were going on in the FBI and CIA. We've all followed Snowden and all the kind of stuff swirling around us here in Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. But really, the beginning of this wasn't even Daniel Ellsberg, who's been a guest on the show numerous times, but is this burglary that took place, the secret envelope that you received at the Washington Post when you were a young reporter there at the Post, covering things that have nothing to do with burglaries. And this is where the saga began, that we began to open America's minds to what the intelligence network was doing. But take us back to that moment when you got this envelope.
Okay. You're right. I mean, this is the crucial beginning. Eight people deciding that they would burglarize an FBI office in order to try to find evidence of whether the FBI was suppressing dissent. The beginning point for me was that 2 weeks after the burglary was the night of March 8th, 1971. We'll come back to that.
Yes, we absolutely will.
Another event happened that night. 2 weeks after that, I went to work one morning, and there was a large manila envelope in my mailbox, along with many, many news releases. But that envelope attracted my attention. The return address was Liberty Publications, Media, Pennsylvania. That didn't mean anything, but it seemed a little unusual. I opened it, and there was a cover letter from the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI. And I had not heard of that. And that's what the group of burglars called themselves. And the cover letter described the fact that on the night of March 8th, 1971, this group of citizens had broken into an FBI office in Media and removed every file in the office.
Every file.
It's interesting because some former agents have told me that they always assumed that the burglary of the media office was an inside job because how in the world would anybody who was not an agent or an agent who worked in the office know how to get the important files that would make these revelations? And I always smiled when people told me that, because they took care of that problem by simply taking everything. The burglary was conducted in the dark without their being able to see what it was that they were stuffing into large suitcases. Anyhow, that morning, it was a small collection of 14 files, and I started reading them. And the first one really caught my attention. It was the file that became emblematic of the media burglary. It was a file instructing agents, especially agents who were covering what the FBI called the New Left, which was a rather large umbrella name for anti-war activists. It advised agents to enhance the paranoia. That's a quote. and to behave in such a way that people would think there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. And that was a stunning thing to see. Mm-hmm. It seemed so strange that that would be in a law enforcement office file. I mean, even if they thought that way, the idea that they would reduce it to writing and have it in their file, that I thought for a moment that maybe I had a hoax in my hands. And so I kept reading. And because I had not so long before been a reporter in Philadelphia, I started recognizing some of the names that were in the files, and that made me convinced it probably was not a hoax. And many of the files were about the black community. I think what got an emphasis as more and more reporting took place, we broke the story, but others immediately reported, was what was going on campuses, which was certainly important, where switchboard operators, campus postal carriers, neighbors of faculty members, and also mid-level campus administrators were hired by the FBI to be informers who spied on students and professors on campuses. But the thing in the end that strikes me as most important, especially in that first set of files that I received, was the blanket surveillance of the black community. I mean, file after file, and all of the media files would talk about surveillance of individual black people or black students, but one of them all described the blanket surveillance of black communities. And although it was specific to Philadelphia, it also described that this was a national project. And for instance, every FBI agent at that time was required to have at least one informer who reported to them on a regular basis on activities of black people. And except in Washington, D.C., where every agent was required to hire at least six agents for the purpose of spying on black people and reporting to the agent on the activities of black people. And it was specific as to where black people might be surveilled. And it was literally any place that an average person would go in their daily life, the corner store, the library, a bar, a restaurant, their classrooms, and that high school, college, churches, just anywhere, informers were spying on black people. And this strikes me as particularly important in a couple ways. For one thing, it shows that one very large segment of the population came under a kind of spying that was very similar to the Stasi in East Germany, where mm-hmm. you never knew who was spying on you, your neighbor.
You're talking about the East German secret police.
East German secret police, right. And under the communist government. I think it also says a great deal that we still don't understand the ramifications of in terms of the impact of this on black Americans. And it ranged from that kind of massive activity all the way to the top, to the impact that Hoover had on successive presidents, guiding them away, for instance, Eisenhower, guiding them away from an impulse to support the civil rights movement because communists are behind it, which naturally, especially with somebody like Eisenhower, caused them to pause considerably, to the truly gross and awful individual acts like the attempt to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide and various other really terrible things that resulted in death. That effect. So black people, the revelations about black people being profoundly affected in negative ways by the FBI due to Hoover's hatred is about the basic way to describe it, I think.
And I think people leave that out a lot in this conversation about your book and about what you discovered.
Yeah. It doesn't get enough attention, I think, and didn't ever.
Right. And so I'm going to probe that a bit more in the course of our conversation. But one of the things I want to mention here, a couple of quick things I think to set this up, is that we all think of Bradley and Graham at the Washington Post as being the editor and publisher who were unafraid to take on the federal government by allowing Woodward and Bernstein to go ahead with Watergate. But before that was this story that you wrote about the Berkeley FBI files, that they also said, we're going to run with this. This is a story we have to do.
It was a struggle, but it happened. This is 3 months before the Pentagon Papers came
before
out.
Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon
before
Papers.
Daniel Ellsberg
right.
came out. And I've talked with Daniel Ellsberg about this, and the burglars were long, I mean, unknown to him. Their names unknown to him. They were people he admired deeply. And he always thought that because they remained unknown, that the substance got the emphasis instead of their personalities.
Right.
And that's how helped the story have a significant impact. But back to your important question. This was the first time that a journalist received secret government files from an outside source, as opposed to an inside whistleblower, an outside source who had stolen the files. So that made people in high positions at the paper
nervous.
Pause. Yes, nervous. And the other thing that's important to understand is that this was the first time that the Nixon administration demanded that Katharine Graham suppress a story. So I didn't realize there was a problem. I thought it was an important story, and at once my most important issue was to get it confirmed as authentic. And that took place rather quickly as soon as we asked the question. Confirmation came from the FBI rather quickly because they used that as a way of trying to convince us not to run the story. While I was off writing the story and recognizing names from Philadelphia and calling and talking to people who were named in some of the files and finished the story at 6, what was going on while I was at work on the story was that John Mitchell, then the attorney general, was calling two editors of the paper, Ben Bagdikian, the national editor, and Ben Bradley, the executive editor, and then also Katharine Graham, the publisher, calling each of them multiple times that afternoon, urging them not to run the story and saying that it would damage national security and possibly damage lives. And fortunately, the documents were very clear, and we could tell that that was not the case. What I found out years later, when I read the 34,000-page FBI investigation of the burglary, was that he hadn't read the files or been briefed on them, and this was just what he used as a routine.
This is Hoover panicking and getting the attorney general to say what he had to try to block this from going on.
Right, 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 right.
And one of the things I do want to jump into this part here because I think this is important and not important, but it's key to the story. That the people who, this committee who went in and broke into the office in Media, Pennsylvania, the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI, they were never caught. They never revealed themselves in all these 40 years who they were. They kept it quiet, and they were never caught.
Never caught.
A bunch of amateurs, never caught.
That's right. 1 year later, there was a group of burglars who became better known.
Watergate burglars.
Who were caught, and every single one of
them. And they were professionals.
They were professionals. Every single one of them was a former FBI agent or a former CIA agent who was trained very well in the art of burglary and carried out many burglaries on behalf of the FBI and the CIA. But the media burglars had no such advantages, which may not have been an advantage. They were smart people, and they just thought this was a problem-solving thing, and how do you pull off a burglary? And they trained themselves as amateur burglars. And they also had the advantage, I'm now able to say, after reading the investigation of it, of an FBI that really was not very good at investigating something like this, a break-in of their own office. When you read the investigation, I mean, you see fundamental mistakes being made from the beginning, especially a decision at the very beginning that they decided who was the leader of the group. And John Peter Grady, who had been a leader in the Catholic peace movement, and they were dead wrong. but they never let go of that, despite lots of indications along the way that they should have picked up that that really wasn't the case. But when the case was closed 5 years later, when the statute of limitations expired, they still thought that John Peter Grady was the leader of the group.
And the group, amazingly, these people who did this burglary kept themselves quiet, didn't expose themselves, talk about it, and hardly saw each other after that for years to come.
Right. About 10 days after the burglary, they had taken their files the night of the burglary to a farmhouse on a Quaker fellowship grounds, about 30 miles away from Philadelphia. And they would return there every night after their day jobs in the city and sort through the files and make decisions about which ones to distribute and so on. And when that period was over and they were ready to start distributing the files, they met for a last time. And the seven of the eight I found, and they are in agreement on this, that they agreed that day to two things. First of all, that they would take the secret of the burglary to their graves, that they would not tell people about it. And the other thing that they agreed to was that they would not see each other, and there were quite close bonds among some of them, and that they would not associate with each other for fear that if one of them was arrested or questioned and was associating with another, that that would lead to that person becoming a suspect. And amazingly, they seem to have kept to that, even as many years went by, unlike maybe the average person. I was going to say many people, but I think just by anybody, if you knew that you had accomplished such a great thing, that you would be tempted to brag about it.
Because what they accomplished was something that was huge. I mean, they really turned the tables in the FBI, the way you describe this and the what has actually happened. I mean, I remember reading this as a young man in the Washington Post and saying, oh, this has been exposed. But really understanding, reading your book, is how deeply it was exposed. The FBI, this organization, had been lauded and loved by America since its founding with J. Edgar Hoover. Now they've been exposed in ways that shocked the nation.
Yeah. It's something that is probably a little difficult to grasp from today's perspective. For instance, J. Edgar Hoover was a folk hero, truly loved by most Americans, not by activists who suspected that he was spying on Americans, especially on them. But he was a folk hero, and this had been a very consciously created iconic image by movies made by Hollywood, which he edited and approved, even investigated everybody who worked on the scene, let alone the actors. A Sunday night series on ABC called the FBI.
Right.
And many books that had been ghostwritten in his name, countless articles and columns, and not cooperating with journalists except those he regarded as friendly journalists who wrote what he wanted them to write. So he was never investigated except by one investigative journalist who, at the time the burglary was coming out, being reported, was Hoover was trying to get him fired from the L.A. Times, Jack Nelson.
Who also got a copy of these files.
Well, didn't get a copy of the
files. Was supposed to get a copy of the files.
There were three journalists who were supposed to get copies. Tom Wicker at the New York Times, Jack Nelson at the L.A. Times, Washington Bureau, and me. And Jack never got his. He never even knew, which was very upsetting to him, he never even knew that a set had been addressed to him because they had been intercepted in the front office of the Bureau and given directly to the FBI that day.
And it's interesting, I mean, that even the people on Capitol Hill who got these turned them over right away, one of them being one of our congressmen who I actually loved a great deal, Perrin Mitchell, and sent them right back to the FBI.
And George McGovern.
And George McGovern. Yeah.
And the New York Times, too. And again, this is before the Pentagon Papers, in which the New York Times played such an important role. I mean, it really is. It's interesting to really that it's at a very crucial time when journalism is about to change a great deal in regard to this type of thing, exposing secrets.
let's take this book on a couple levels here. One of the levels that you explored this book through were the lives of the people that you were able to find who committed the burglary, that took these FBI files because they thought they had a duty as Americans to expose what the FBI was doing to our country, and so put those things out there. And you found these people, the ones you could.
Seven out of eight. Yeah.
And so talk about how you found them.
Well, I wasn't looking for them.
Right.
It was an accident. They were anonymous, of course, to me and everybody else who received files from them back in 1971. And actually, I wasn't looking for them. I felt a need to protect them. I was concerned that there might be fingerprints, and I didn't want the files I received to get into the hands of law enforcement. But I didn't feel a need or an interest in finding out who they were. But then, many years later, after I had moved to California from Washington and had been living in California for quite some time, and I had a trip to the Midwest and then a trip to Massachusetts, and I had a long weekend between those two appointments, and so I decided to give myself a gift of a long weekend in Philadelphia. And I had worked there through 1969 before going to the Washington Post, and there were a number of old friends and acquaintances, colleagues I'd like to see. So I filled up my schedule with appointments, and I arrived on a Friday, and that evening, two of the people that I had made arrangements to see were John and Bonnie Raines.
That's
and
so funny.
I called them. They said, come to our house that evening for dinner. And we hadn't, they had been acquaintances, people I liked when I lived in Philadelphia. And I hadn't seen them, we hadn't seen each other, I think, for more than a decade at that point. So it was one of those occasions where we're happy to see each other and we're catching each other up on years of our lives since we last saw each other. And eventually we went to the dinner table. And while the three of us were eating, their fourth child, their youngest child, whom I had never met, came in to ask one of them a question. And John Raines said, Mary, we want you to meet Betty, because many years ago when your dad and mother had information about the FBI, we wanted the American people to know, we gave it to Betty. And I just about died. And it was obvious that Mary, who I think was 14 or 15, and, you know, it went right over her head, and I understood that. And I couldn't wait until she left the room, and I could ask them about it. And eventually she did, and I said, are you telling me that you were media burglars? And they said, yes. And John swears to this day that it was an accident, that he didn't intend.
Didn't mean to let it out?
He didn't mean to let it out, because they had taken seriously. Their children at that time, they hadn't yet told their children, who were older teens. And so the rest of the evening and into the wee hours of the morning, we talked and talked. I had lots of questions. And not long after that, I thought that this is just such an important story, and I respected the fact that they had told me about that vow of secrecy they had all taken. And I got in touch with them later and said, you know, this strikes me as such an important piece of history, and how people were able to make a decision to do such a thing and to risk their freedom for many years and then have the result that you had. I would like very much to write a book about this. Would you consider that? And then would you also try to find the other burglars, help me find the other burglars, and see whether they would agree to participate? And so that's how it started.
That's just an amazing story. That's when I read, that just cracked me up, just imagining you or anybody else in that situation. Seeing people you knew for years being the ones who actually sent it to you.
I had no idea. I mean, part of the explanation of that is that the peace movement in Philadelphia was so enormous, and I should say also so effective. It was a place where extreme organizations worked more cooperatively, I think, than probably any other city in the country. And as John keeps saying, in public speeches.
John Raines.
John Raines. Right. That it was possible to just melt into that community. I mean, that's not to say that they didn't have many moments of fear, but most of them did, in fact, melt into that community.
And John was John and Bonnie, right?
But the, John and Bonnie.
Bonnie. They were the ones who were part of the Freedom Rides.
John had been a freedom rider. That was the beginning of John's activism. He was a young Methodist minister in a small church on Long Island in 1961, and he got this core invitation.
Congress of Racial Equality.
Congress of Racial Equality to go on a freedom ride, and he signed up for it. And he looks back. I mean, it was a really quite striking decision, because up until that time, he had never even preached a sermon about civil rights. It had not been a core interest of his. I mean, he was interested in racial justice, but he hadn't lived his life so that it was part of his work. But he thought this was a good idea. Well, it transformed his life. His father had been a bishop in the Methodist Church, and they had lived a very upper class life as the children of the bishop, and he had gone to Carleton College and Union Seminary, and now was about to go back to Union to become a scholar in Christian social ethics. He never really intended to practice Christian social ethics by getting arrested, but now he was about to enter the rest of his life where that was a possibility. And going south, he then went south almost every summer after that. And faced quite dangerous circumstances along with many other
people. Many people.
And learned from black people in the South as he worked alongside them what it really meant to participate in the risk of resistance. And says he never would have been able to have gone to media had it not been for his immersion in the civil rights movement in the South.
So let's take a step here for a moment. Before we really kind of investigate what was exposed, which I think I want our listeners to really understand the kind of the nature of what was exposed on a number of levels, from COINTELPRO to the spying to all the other things that were exposed here about the FBI, which began to turn the corner for America, at least in that period of time, about what our intelligence services were doing, to talk for a moment just about who these people were. Because your book wanders, that's how it wanders through these eyes of these people who did this and where they are now and what they've become. So take us through these people.
Okay. That's always a pleasure.
And how they got together, who they are. Because these are very ordinary university professors, students who had decided to make this commitment at a risk of their own lives. They could have gone to jail.
Yeah. I'm all, people like to refer to them as ordinary Americans, and I understand the desire to do that because they look like the rest of us. And that's true. In by calling them ordinary Americans, it sort of makes you realize that the rest of us might be able to find courage, too.
Yeah.
They were, in fact, extraordinary people. Bill Davidon was the leader of the group, and without Bill, it would not have happened. Not very many people were able to conceive of burglarizing an FBI office at that point. Bill was a physics professor, very soft-spoken, mild-mannered person, but very strong. And he taught at Haverford. And he had been involved in the anti-war movement from the beginning. Dear to his heart and mind from the time of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, was to oppose nuclear the use and development of nuclear weapons, and so that deep concern just naturally made him opposed to the war, because nuclear weapons were always on the table during the Vietnam War, and that was a deep, deep concern to him. So, Bill was an optimistic person generally, but by 1969, 1970, as the war continued sort of relentlessly, people in the peace movement were getting more and more frustrated, and there was a fringe of the peace movement that itself was becoming violent. And Bill was deeply concerned about the war continuing and also seeing people become so hopeless. And so he was looking for. He was also he was a pacifist, even though he was a Navy veteran of World War II. He was a pacifist, and he was looking for more aggressive forms of nonviolence, hoping to arouse the public more. And he never expected to find hope and teachers among Catholics, but that's what happened, because he found in the Catholic peace movement and in the teachings of Dorothy Day and Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan the kind of aggressive nonviolence that he was looking for, that they had that same desire. And the trial of the Catonsville Nine, and as Dan had written it into a play, he found that deeply inspiring. And so he had become part of the Catholic left by early 1970. And he was astounded to learn that they had moved from doing an action and then waiting to be arrested to reading draft boards at night clandestinely and not waiting and fleeing, trying to avoid arrest. And at first that deeply shocked him, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then as he looked at what he thought was their effectiveness, he decided that this was the best thing that was going on at the time, and that he did find some hope in that. And then later on, in 1970, as he was moving from one peace organization to another in Philadelphia, very different types of organizations, academics, the resistance, a group there that counseled men about the draft. As he moved from one organization to another, he kept hearing the same concern, people taking him aside and saying, you know, we think there are spies in our midst. And he didn't believe it. I mean, he was somebody who didn't believe in conspiracy theories. He didn't speculate, and it's part of his training as a scientist. But by late 1970, he had become convinced that it probably was true. And he thought it wasn't enough that activists felt free to go around saying, of course the FBI is in our midst. That what was needed was for the public to know about this. And the only way that the public, you could have any impact with the public on this issue would be if you got evidence that it actually was going on. And so he knew enough to know that Hoover had never been investigated. Congress didn't ask Hoover any questions, nor did attorney generals, and especially with the Nixon administration, it was unlikely that they would disapprove of this. If it was happening.
Yeah, right.
We certainly found that out later on. So he then fastened on the idea that the only way that you can find the evidence is if average citizens are willing to take the risk of losing their freedom for many years and break into an FBI office and search for files that would provide this evidence. And so that's how we got to the point of Bill deciding, I'm going to ask a small group of people that I deeply trust what they think of the idea of burglarizing an FBI. And then he asked each person individually.
So when this was exposed, let's talk for a minute about two things. Let's start with what really was exposed here. I mean, you talked to me at the beginning of our conversation about all the things were happening to the black community that were exposed in this. And I think that was just the beginning of many people in the black movement, especially realizing how much they were being spied on and who was going after and how they were being targeted.
That's right. You know, many black people, like many activists in the peace movement, thought that things like this were going on with local police departments as well as the FBI. But here was evidence that it was taking place. We should say that the overall reaction was quite strong. I mean, when the first stories were published, there was an outcry in Congress. And Congress had been as worshipful of Hoover as the American public was. And so for the first time, we had a number of senators calling for an investigation of Hoover and the FBI because of these initial stories that described the kind of surveillance, of domestic surveillance of people for their political beliefs that was taking place. And also editorials all over the country. were written calling for investigations. And this was quite striking because these took place in newspapers such as the Philadelphia Inquirer, where only adulatory things had been written about.
Right, forever.
About Hoover, yeah, forever. So this was quite strong at first. And there was also a focus on by the individual senators and by the editorials, there was a focus on Senator Sam Ervin, who was the had just conducted hearings of Army intelligence conducting domestic surveillance of Americans. And also he was just simply known as a great defender of the Constitution. And as people well remember through the years how he conducted the Watergate hearings. But when he was called on at this time to conduct an investigation of domestic intelligence illegal activity by the FBI, he refused. And it's interesting to look back on that. Because I think that the investigation of the FBI probably would have taken place much sooner than 1975, when it did take place, if Senator Ervin hadn't felt that Hoover really was doing a fine job, which was what he stated, despite what had become known.
Which is why Hoover panicked so much when these things were released, because it was released showing him the kind of absurd things he did internally. And
well,
from the shape of people's heads to not hiring anybody who is black, maybe reasons not to hire somebody. I mean, pear-shaped heads, I think you were one of the things that was in the documents were exposed. I mean, to that kind of thing, to the more horrendous things he was doing.
That's right. I mean, just the cult of personality, like the illustration on how agents were supposed to celebrate his birthday and the holidays by sending gifts and cards. Though also that anyone who had a pear-shaped head, and I'm not quite sure what that is, or sweaty palms. I mean, these things sound so ridiculous to us now, but when you graduated from the FBI Academy, the graduates were brought to the FBI offices, headquarters, and everyone paraded through and shook hands with him. And if you had sweaty palms, you weren't permitted to continue being an FBI agent. But that's the least. That's just indicative of other problems.
I mean, because one of the things that really struck me was, and I'd forgotten that this actually came out in this report, were the plan to the Emergency Detention Act.
That's right.
The plan to arrest 20,000 Americans.
Security Index.
Right.
Yeah, the media files really, when that door was opened, it was open to a lot of different kinds of information, including two of the most important operations he had, the Security Index and then COINTELPRO.
And COINTELPRO.
But the Security Index was something that had been operating since the 30s. And this was a list of people a list created by Hoover and other FBI officials of people that they thought should be arrested and detained without habeas corpus at a time of national emergency. And at one point, an attorney general who found out about this, Francis Biddle, ordered him to close this down and destroy the files and said this is unconstitutional to make this kind of judgment about people being subversive on the basis of, you know, informants, observations. And he agreed to do that, but he didn't do it. He changed the name of it.
And this exposed that.
And this was a – this was that's right. This
right.
exposed it. And this was a typical – we later emerged – a typical strategy of his, that he would change the names of things so that they could never – he could lie about – and his officials could lie about whether something existed. And he would write, you know, say, there no longer is this such-and-such index, and instead we have now changed it to the Security Index. And that happened even in 1971 – with COINTELPRO. But that index then had continued to be developed and it was exposed by the media files.
I mean, I think that, you know, before I just one other question about where we are today with all this, because I think your book just opened up so much for people to wrestle with what we could be facing in the future, because the unleashing of intelligence once again in American society because of 9/11. But also, I think this is the other part of this was the great bungling of this, the effort by the FBI to catch the burglars, and it was a circus. What was it called? Medburg was the name of the investigation they gave it, the code name.
Right, for media burglary.
Right, for media burglary. But the circus of closing down FBI offices around the country and moving people around to find these people, spending, I guess, literally millions of dollars, if I remember correct from the book, and also the reaction of people in communities kind of ridiculing the FBI as they were doing it. I mean...
Well, although the investigation was widespread throughout the Northeast and the upper Midwest and various other places, the focus of it really was, of course, Philadelphia, and within Philadelphia, a neighborhood out right beyond the University of Pennsylvania called Powelton Village, where a great many anti-war activists lived. And so the FBI almost lived there, too, in their cars, round the clock. Placing residents under surveillance. The residents eventually sued after two houses were broken into by the FBI, where it was unnecessary to break in. If they had knocked on the doors, the people would have been.
Right, it's a quick woman's house. They broke in, broke the door, and then...
and then took out her typewriter.
Her typewriter, right.
Her files, her books. And the neighbors sued for the kind of surveillance, the way the FBI was acting there at that time. 200 agents were brought in to Philadelphia to conduct the investigation, and it was completely unsuccessful. Repeatedly in the course of the 34,000 pages that I read, they would say, we have no evidence, and this was true at the very end, too. We have absolutely no evidence, no fingerprints, and we have no direct or indirect witnesses to provide testimony. I mean, there literally was total failure in the investigation.
And I guess in a sense, how you also end the book and the things you talk about, that giving us kind of, we need to all take the pause and think about the power of intelligence agencies, where we are with Edward Snowden and other things going on in our society now, and reflecting back 40 years ago about what it was like and what it took to kind of rein in.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. And one of the important things that happened very early was that for the first time, there was a national conversation about intelligence gathering,
right,
and the role of intelligence agencies in a democratic society. It was intense at first, and then when Irvin refused to conduct the investigation, the timbre of it changed, and then the Pentagon Papers came out.
Daniel Ellsberg.
And then Watergate stories and Hoover's death also helped create a different atmosphere. And then as Watergate developed, we also the public was learning then about the involvement of intelligence agencies, how they were manipulated for political purposes, both the CIA and the FBI and NSA and IRS, as a matter of fact. But that buzz, a discourse about intelligence was taking place for the first time in history. And then a very crucial thing happened, and that was Carl Stern seeing a media file that was a mere label for a file, and it had the term COINTELPRO at the top. And I and anyone else who received it, we didn't know what it meant.
Right.
And Carl hadn't seen it until a little more than a year later when he was in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And someone showed him some of the media files. And he looked at that and he thought, that seems so strange. What is that? And then he also was captured by some writing at the bottom. It was instructions to agents to distribute the actual file, which was a story that appeared in Barron's on advice. It was advice to college administrators on how to control protesters on their campuses. And it was advice to agents to distribute it to friendly administrators in person and to write anonymous letters to other college administrators and send it to them. And Carl thought, that seems like such a strange idea that the FBI would be told to write anonymous letters. Later, we read about far more harmful anonymous letters that the FBI wrote. So he started asking for the founding papers that would establish what COINTELPRO was. And the FBI said no, and the Attorney General said no. And he asked repeatedly, and Patrick Gray was the acting director, and he said no, this would endanger national security, and so did the acting Attorney General. Watergate was starting to develop, and so we started having a lot of acting attorney generals in place. And Carl was persistent, and he refused to take no for an answer, and he filed a Freedom of Information suit against the FBI asking for this file. And this was extraordinary at the time, and we think of Freedom of Information suits now as fairly common things. The Freedom of Information Act was first passed, a federal act, in 1966, and Hoover had worked forcefully against it. And when it was passed, he told officials to ignore it, to not respond to any request for information. And nobody ever had received anything in response to an FOI request. And they refused again and again. And finally, he sued in federal court. And by the fall of 73, a federal judge ordered the FBI to provide Carl with the files. It amounted to only four pages, and they still refused. And the Justice Department wanted to appeal this decision. And you might be interested in knowing who said, no, we're going to hand this over, which was Robert Bork, who was the Solicitor General at the time. And he provided the files. And these files were the beginning of the American people really being shocked to learn what the FBI was doing. They were in the founding documents were in Hoover's words, and it was specifically about the COINTELPRO New Left, and it was about the fact that this operation would be conducted around the country in all of the offices. And it was designed to disrupt and distort individuals and organizations in political movements. And that meant just about any movement for rights that you could think of, black movements, women's rights movements, gay rights movements.
Black Panthers, SDS, yeah, all of them.
Everything. Right. There were these general categories as well as specific organizations. And the tactics used were also used outside COINTELPRO, but COINTELPRO was the way we found out about the truly degrading and sometimes even violent tactics that were used, such as disinformation, breaking up marriages by planting false rumors.
So Betty, as we conclude this, I think it'd be important to talk about kind of the outcomes of this that we touched on earlier in our conversation, but never got to. Just the positive outcomes of this, what this ended up. I mean, I think that, you know, all of us owe kind of these burglars and you a debt of gratitude to what doors were opened 44 years ago. In all this. So what were these two positive outcomes we were alluding to earlier in our conversation?
Well, by 1974, really, there really was a spirit of reform that was pretty strong in the country in regard to intelligence agencies. So many revelations had come out, and the tipping point came with a story Cy Hirsch wrote in December of 1974 in the New York Times about the fact that the CIA, in violation of its charter, was in fact conducting massive domestic surveillance of Americans, and the Congress no longer could be inactive, and in less than a month, both houses of Congress established over committees to investigate all intelligence agencies. And in the end, the one that mattered was the Senate Select Committee, which was known as the Church Committee, after Frank Church, the chair of the committee. It conducted extensive investigations, and many things were revealed. Agents testified, and one of the things that came out was that they had no sense of caring about the ethics of what they were doing, the morality of what they were doing, or whether or not their actions were legal, and they were quite specific about that in their testimony. And so that really opened the eyes of the public, I think. And when those hearings were over, Congress then acted, and a number of changes were made. First change that was easy to make was that there was a limit on how long an FBI director could serve, a maximum of 10 years, recognizing that the half century that Hoover had served was part of the problem, that he really came to think of it as his domain. And other things that happened were the establishment of permanent oversight committees, permanent intelligence oversight committees. Prior to the media burglary, there was no oversight of intelligence operations in this country. And by 1975, after those investigations, that happened. And those committees continue today. And that has gone in and out of effectiveness, ineffectiveness, as we know from recent
history. You're
watching
at the moment.
But the mechanisms were there, and they could be grabbed if people wanted to use them, and occasionally they have been used effectively. I tend to think that in the long run, the most effective change that came out of that era of reform was the 1974 strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act, which made it somewhat easier for citizens to get agencies, and especially the intelligence agencies, to hand over documents that they request. It's still difficult and requires a great deal of endurance, but it's much easier than it was prior to that. And it's led to dozens of books being written and hundreds of articles that wouldn't have been possible except for journalists and scholars' ability to have access to authentic, original FBI files.
Betty Metzger, once again, this has been such a pleasure to read this book, to have you on the show with us, and to thank you for many of us for the work you've done in breaking the story way back in 1970 and writing the book to kind of flesh out the story here, the burglary, the discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's secret FBI. We'll be linking to all this on our website by Betty Metzger, M-E-D-S-G-E-R, for those who want the spelling. Betty, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
And on the way out of here today, we're hearing the Scatterlites performing Malcolm X, who was born on this day, as we're all talking about today, in 1925.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.